This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The first Republican Party candidate debate for the 2024 presidential election featured Donald Trump in spirit, but not in person. Most of the gathered candidates raised their hands when asked if they would support the former president if he were to win their party's nomination, and they would do so even if he's convicted of crimes. Trump faces a whopping 91 felony charges. Yes Magazine's senior editor Chris Winters writes that if that sounds like a lot, quote, it's because Donald Trump was excessive in committing crimes in multiple jurisdictions. Chris is my colleague at Yes, where he specializes in covering democracy and the economy. His latest op-ed is entitled Indictment Days Are Here Again. Welcome back to the program, Chris.
Hi, Sonali. Good to be here again.
So first, let's talk about the fact that we are talking about this inordinate number of charges. Even one major charge against a former president would have been, or a handful would have been unprecedented. Trump is facing four charges in four different jurisdictions for a multiplicity of crimes, as you lay out in your article. It took years for these charges to actually come to fruition. You know, it's 2023 now, and many of these were for alleged crimes done several years ago. And we're getting ready for the next election already. Is Trump just going to be like stumping for votes and doing political rallies at the same time as he's appearing in courts? What is our election year going to look like next year?
Well, that's exactly what's going to happen. This week, we learned that we are the start of the trial date for the election interference case, the January 6th case, is going to start on March 4th. And that is the day before Super Tuesday. And throughout the primary season calendar, Trump is going to have trial dates. We have three out of the four trial dates are going to happen by May of next year. We don't know when the Georgia case is going to happen yet. But it's entirely possible that the Georgia case is going to have a trial date sometime before July, which is when the Republican National Convention is going to be. So yes, Trump is going to be burning a lot of jet fuel more than he normally would, because he has dates to keep in other places that have nothing to do with the election and everything to do with being a criminally indicted. So yes,
I mean, his presidency was unprecedented in what it did, and here we are again watching him get ready for re-election and seeing history being written. You write in your story for Yes that, quote, voters have a right to know if Trump is guilty or not guilty before casting their votes. I suppose even one conviction would be good enough. So do you foresee any of the many cases wrapping up before next November's election?
Yeah, definitely. Most likely. The actual trials do not take that long. I think the estimate that was given for the January 6th case was 3 or 4 weeks or something like that. So we will have verdicts in, possibly all four, maybe three out of the four trials. I don't think that we will have gone through the entire appeals process for most of them, but I think that, yes, we will be able to say definitively whether or not Trump is guilty and have the force of law to back us up on that. So,
now, you mentioned in your story that no one can defeat Trump by ignoring him. He has to be confronted head on and destroyed. Maybe Chris Christie is the one to do that, but I'm still waiting for the evidence. Last week's GOP candidate debate featured multiple candidates, but not Trump. And Chris Christie was one of those candidates. And he was one of those that didn't raise his hands. Well, apparently he like made some hand gesture and then clarified later on that he didn't actually raise his hand. Did that debate offer any evidence of someone countering, in this case, Chris Christie, Trump in any effective way?
Well, I think the key word in that question is effective, because Chris Christie did what he said he was going to do and attacked Trump. And that is actually different from the 2016 race, where no one dared confront Trump directly. But I'm not so sure that it's Chris Christie is going to make that much of a difference this time. When he opened his mouth at the debate, he got booed. There were also some cheers, but he also got booed. But the thing about Trump is that his followers are, you know, rabid. So they've been, his approval has been remarkably consistent. I was looking at some of the polling numbers. 538's, you know, averages out all the polls, and Trump's approval is something like, his favorability is something like 39.9% today, but that's barely changed. It was 39.5 on January 1st this year. And even if you go back to early February of 2021 at the start of the Biden administration, Trump's approval and disapproval ratings have not fluctuated by more than 5% in any direction. So it's remarkably consistent. So I don't see, when it comes to Trump's followers, he's bulletproof. The question is how it's going to affect the non-aligned voters, the people who normally would stay home, perhaps. So that's what I'm waiting to see.
So there's the effect that the indictments have on Trump, or the non-effect. But what about the effect that Trump has on everything else? On the candidates, last week in the GOP candidate debate, aside from Chris Christie, and even to a tiny level, Mike Pence, although Mike Pence was the one who was one of those who raised his hand saying that even if Trump was convicted, he would support him in the nomination. But how did Trump's presence, his influence, manifest on the debate stage? How has he utterly reshaped the party?
Well, that hand-raising exercise is kind of like the shorthand for what has happened, because 6 out of the 8 people on that stage basically said they'd be okay with a felon in the White House and they'd get behind and support him. And that's not what you would do if you wanted to defeat that person with a criminal conviction. These were people who were saying, we are subservient to Trump. All of them said that mattered, essentially. Vivek Ramaswamy, who a lot of, you know, pundits are coming out saying, you know, came out fairly well in the debates. He's kind of adopted the Trumpish charisma aspect, saying, you know, he's putting on the clown suit, so to speak, and trying to appeal to voters that way. Ron DeSantis was trying to say, I'm Trumpish, but I'm competent. And that didn't go over so well. And, you know, his polling, he was the early leader of the alternatives to Trump pack, but he peaked rather early, so he's probably, you know, got nowhere to go but down now. Mike Pence, he's probably the only one on that stage who actually truly believes that he has a shot at being president, and I think it's because he's just not that smart. But even he, you know, he is unwilling to offend the voters who were shouting, hang Mike Pence outside the Capitol on January 6th. So it's, you know, it is Trump's party one way or another, and everyone else just has to try and live in it.
There was an opinion piece on Tuesday by Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times entitled, Vivek Ramaswamy is very annoying. It's why he's surging in the polls. Is that also the Trump effect that, and you know, it sort of goes to the heart of why Trump continues to be unaffected by everything that our system slaps at him? Is that the defiance is the point, the bullying is the point, the being annoying is the point?
Yeah, I read that column, and I think Michelle Goldberg is right in a lot of ways, and one of the things she said is that conservatives love it when people are championing them who would ordinarily disdain them. And here we have Vivek Ramaswamy, a non-white Republican, getting up there and trying to champion a party that is about white supremacy first and foremost. As we said during the first Trump administration, listen to me, the cruelty is the point, right? You know, it was, you know, being a bully is everything. And bullies are people who, you know, they want other people to knuckle under. And that seems to be the path that Vivek Ramaswamy is trying to chart. You know, as somebody said and was famously quoted During the Trump administration, when Trump's incompetence was starting to manifest, someone was quoted as saying, he's not hurting the right people. And that's kind of Trumpism in a nutshell. It's who are you going to beat up?
So if we have this scenario, we're talking about not just a reshaping of the Republican Party, we're talking about a reshaping of society. However, a lot of our media coverage focuses on the Republican voting base, and those polls you were citing earlier, show that he remains popular among the Republican voting base. But what about among the general voting public? Have the indictments hurt him politically? Generally speaking, although Republican voters tend to be very reliable voters, very consistent voters, very enthusiastic voters, and some of them try to vote more than once, as we found in the last election, in spite of all of their claims of voter fraud on the other side, it's still an election that is supposed to be, in spite of the Electoral College, supposed to be one where the general public has a say, and more often than not, the popular vote has backed the Electoral College vote. So where does he stand in the general election in terms of his impact on our country?
That approvability, that rating from the 538 polls at 39.9, that is from the general public. He has his hardcore base of support, but most people and that poll, which is supposed to be representative, don't like him. The question is, will they vote? And I think, like a lot of elections, turnout is going to be the key issue. Can we get enough people at the polls who feel that way and who are willing to elect Joe Biden, or at very least just vote against Trump, no matter who the nominee turns out to be?
Let's talk about the narratives that are playing out in these indictments that Trump is facing, in the electioneering that's already happening. My goodness, it's going to be a long 14 months. There is Trump, who his mugshot has already become iconic. And depending on who you are, you read certain things into it. If you're Marjorie Taylor Greene, you read that this is the face that's going to win the election. And if you look at others, there's memes that are floating around ridiculing him. But he's angry. He's grimacing. He is this, to Marjorie Taylor Greene, he's the strong white man, the father figure. He's above the law, which again is the point. And then there's the people who are trying to hold him accountable. They symbolize the opposition. A lot of them are people of color, like Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg, Fannie Willis, the Georgia DA, who are trying to apply the law. What do you make of the fact that the so-called law and order crowd seems to have become very comfortable with their hypocrisy? That it's okay for Trump to be above the law. In fact, it's great for Trump to be above the law in their mind. But everybody else, we have to be following laws, and we have to be held accountable.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they've become comfortable with their hypocrisy, I think that their hypocrisy is they've basically become out and proud about saying, we are going to be an anti-democratic party. The laws are for you to follow, not for us. And they are just, I guess Trump gave them permission to say the quiet part out loud these days. But that's what we're really looking at. I mean, it is hypocritical if you are talking about, the rules of debate in conventional society. They've decided they're just not going to be in that realm anymore. They are going to be, out and proud, like I said, about being an authoritarian party. It's kind of sad that it's come to this with one of the two major parties in American politics, but there you have it. It's, it is the party that has said we are anti-democratic, and they've thrown out any pretense of, playing by the rules and being fair going forward.
One of the other narratives that played out recently, I don't know if you saw it in the debate last week, the GOP played this song by a country singer who's suddenly had a song go to the top of the the charts, Anthony Oliver, I believe is his name, or Oliver Anthony, rather, Richmond, north of Richmond. And they actually played the song at the debate and asked candidates like DeSantis about why it's striking such a chord in the country. And of course, it turned out later on that this kid, he's a young guy, disavowed the Republican Party. And said, you know, these are the people that I'm writing the song about. But still, his song did have, you know, these very judgmental conservative tropes, which is, I am not making enough money, and it's the fault of the people who are sucking up welfare, which is very standard kind of Republican talking point. And I'm wondering, you know, if this kid is saying that the Republicans are also the problem, and yet he's spouting conservative tropes, really, what is the challenge for progressive candidates here? Because the ills that he's talking about, the societal ills, are one that we all agree on. It's the solutions that we disagree on.
Right, right, yes. And I think that's, I mean, you know, I think it's got, a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of these folks are young and they don't remember another time when that Republican hypocrisy was part of the machine. I mean, country music used to be about the poor and the you know, the down and out, and you know how society has kicked them around, and you know they're working people just trying to get by, and you know the labor unionists in a lot of ways. But you know, starting in about 1992, I would attest it's Lee Greenwood's Proud to Be an American that turned country music into this right-wing cultural force. But it was also Reaganism that flipped the script on that, to blame the poor or you know, blame the non-white poor for the problems that the white poor were
the feeding. The welfare queen trope, which is basically just code for black women.
Exactly, yeah. And it stuck. And, you know, this was a time in the 1980s that I grew up in. You know, I'm giving away my age there, but, you know, it is possible for some people to remember a time when that wasn't part of just the background noise, but it's persisted. It's everywhere and ubiquitous. And it's just kind of taken as writ among the Republican circles. And, you know, the Republican adjacent circles, including, you know, the country music world, you know, where it's, if you're, you know, writing a song about being down and out and poor more often than not, you're not going to be blaming the factory owners for keeping you down. It's going to be looking at someone else that's a more convenient political target. So,
and the rich men that Oliver Anthony writes, I think, talks about is maybe Republicans, but he sees the Democrats probably as part of the problem, right? Because the so-called liberal elites are part of the problem. This is another trope that the right wing harps on about quite a lot. So let's end with the question of what is the challenge for Democrats here? And you know, we see this same ideological battle play out in every election among progressives, which is how to convince, especially those who are uninspired by Democratic candidates and nominees, to come out and vote for those nominees, hold their nose and vote for those nominees, just to keep the extremist, white supremacist, racist, right-wing candidate a nominee out of office. And every 4 years, we have to convince ourselves to choose the lesser of two evils. And it feels like it's, you know, 2024 is going to be the same, right?
I think it's going to be the same in every election going forward. And I think the reason for that is because one of the two parties that are essentially by this point hardwired into the American political system has abandoned democracy. And only massive voter turnout is going to prevent them from coming into power and dismantling democracy. That is their stated goal now. They're already in many states, they're pushing back on voter laws. They're trying to restrict who gets to vote, make it harder. If, you know, a Republican administration, whether it's Trump or not, is going to be looking at that and dismantling it. And unfortunately, you know, when you have a, you know, what is essentially a party that is trying to become a one-party state, only massive voting numbers in opposition are going to prevent that. And it's going to be true in 2024. It's going to be true in 2028. It'll be true in the midterm elections in 2026. It even matters in local elections in the off years. It's, we have seen a lot of these culture war issues showing up in school boards, for example, or in city council halls, since city council halls. It's a persistent thing, and saving democracy, I think, is kind of one, the premier, issue that going forward that people need to rally around. We saw how abortion played a role after the Dobbs decision, how it
In the
turned around
midterms, right?
in elections. Yeah, we saw the effect there. And you can say that, you can look at that and say, this is abortion rights. It's always appealed to women voters primarily and of a certain, age. But abortion is essentially a rights case too, and it's a right like voting rights too. And rights not to be harassed by the police when you're out demonstrating and being peaceful, as we saw in 2020. Rights are on the ballot. I mean, I guess that's the easiest way to put it. Democracy as a whole is about preserving rights. And when you have one party that is in opposition to rights, you're looking at, two choices there. This is kind of like the choice that was, that faced by voters in Eastern Europe in 1989 when the Berlin Wall was coming down, the Iron Curtain was lifting, and it was a choice between the old, one-party state or you're going to vote for a multi-party democracy. And multi-party democracy won, even though, it's inconsistently applied across the region. You want to see what a one-party state looks like? Look at Russia today. Look at China. And rights are not exactly in their DNA to begin with, but it's kind of hard to see that anything would happen in those states that wouldn't actually be part and parcel of the party's agenda. We don't want to be that country, I don't think. I
Right.
think, we need a strong Democratic Party. But I think you also need to, the key to democracy being the peaceful transfer of power. The losers have to realize that they've got skin in the game and accept the results. And right now we've got a party that doesn't play by that rule. And that's a real problem. And that puts every election into an existential corner for us. And only massive voter turnout is going to, keep that at bay, I'm afraid.
Right. And I still can't believe that it is basically end of summer 2023 that we're talking about an election that's going to take place in the fall of 2024. Chris, we'll link to your story in Yes Magazine. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thank you again, Sonali.
My guest has been Chris Winter, senior editor at Yes, where he specializes in covering democracy and the economy. His latest story at Yes is Indictment Days Are Here Again. You can find it at yesmagazine.org. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews at our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.